All right, everybody, we'll let folks take a seat. It's really, really great to be here and to get a chance to talk with you. A little bit about myself. My name is Gersh, and I'm a senior software developer on the Xbox One team. A little bit of history. I've spent my entire career working on developer platforms, on tools you might have heard of. I've worked on SQL Server, I've worked on Visual Studio, I've worked on Microsoft Office, I've worked on the 360, was one of the first developers on Smart Glass, and spent the last couple years working really, really hard to bring the Xbox One. To me, there's always a human aspect to everything that we do in the software that we work on, and I want to tell you a story about that kind of sums up why we worked really, really hard on Xbox One and what the platform means to me. I have a friend who's a designer back in Redmond, Washington, where I work, and he was telling me last week about an idea he has for an application where he makes an interesting use of gesture. And I won't go into details on the application because he promised me not to share it with you so you don't copy it. But as I watched him and his eyes light up and he talked about how excited he was about bringing this application to market, and then he dropped a little bit as he talked about he didn't think he could build it. And he said, I mean, I do a little bit of HTML, CSS. I know enough JavaScript to be dangerous, but I don't really know assembly or whatever they use to go build games. And I told him, I said, well, you tune in about a week when I'm going to talk about what we've been really working on and what I want to share with you, which is how we've made it really, really easy to make it so that anybody who has an idea and who's creative and who comes from maybe a business background and has a little bit of tech can build an app for Xbox. So here's what we're going to talk about today. First, I'm going to give you a quick overview of what the Xbox One application platform is and some insight and some history that we kind of haven't shared before, but an insider's look at, as someone who's built it, you know, what went through our thinking as we put it together. And then we'll talk about the 10-foot experience, just a little bit from a building UI perspective. And then the last three things we're going to go through, the major inputs on Xbox, which when you think about building for Xbox, those are the two things you think about is input and output. Output being the fact that it's 10 feet, things are a little bit bigger, and the fact that there are different inputs that you have to think about when you're building your application. And I've helped now at this point hundreds of developers, really, really big developers whose brands you've probably heard of, down to really small developers, get on the platform. And this talk is really about bringing all of those conversations, all of that knowledge into one point so that I can share it with you guys. And so that my goal is when you walk away, you maybe came in, there's a lot of questions around what does it mean to go build an app for Xbox, how do they do it? And you walk away at the end of this with the knowledge that you understand kind of what it takes and you could see some of your ideas translating an Xbox app. So the first question, and this was a question that has been throughout the entire project as we were working on Xbox One, and I think still today we're still coming to terms with what it means to be next generation. It's been a long time since we launched the console. It's not something you do every year, and the 360 came out several years ago, and our new console, Xbox One, is really, you'll hear the word next generational thrown around, and I just want to describe what it means to me personally is three things. The first is natural user interface. And this is really a game changer. This is about changing how you as a user interact with your television. We think about the traditional method, which is a directional navigation pattern that you'd use with a controller. And if you think about on 360, if I wanted to go watch a movie on Netflix, I would have to take my controller, and I'd have to maybe go over to the left, over to the left, over to my apps tile, and then I'd have to go down, I'd have to select that, I'd get to all my apps, and then I'd have to go over a few times to the end section, click Netflix, launch the app. And that was kind of the experience and really actually the state of the art even up until very recently. But in Xbox One, we really turned that on its ear, and you can just say, Xbox, go to Netflix, and there you are. And simple things like that, it just completely changes the way that we used to do things. And there's so much potential for that, and I see it all the time. Another example that I like to point to is Xbox Fitness. And Xbox Fitness is an app that uses a Kinect to see what you as the user are performing exercises and give you tips and be a personal trainer and help you out with those exercises. And I was talking to the lead creative director on that project, and he was telling me that what you effectively had was an industry where you'd buy, and this was a while ago, but most of you probably remember, like, you'd buy a VHS tape that would have a fitness exercise or set of exercises on it. You put it in, and you try to do the exercises. And that's effectively like the same content that they actually brought forward with Xbox Fitness, which just has a bunch of that content for exercises. But you layer Kinect in there, and you layer in this system that can see down to finger joints in terms of accuracy and depth data and can really see into the room. You walk in front of it, it instantly recognizes you, knows who you are, and says hello. And the fact that you can be a little bit off on an exercise and it can tell you and give you feedback, to me, taking those VHS tapes, layering on Kinect, you suddenly create a transformative experience. And I've seen that happen in domain after domain after domain after domain. But really, like, we just launched and we're at the beginning. And what that means is there's a wide open blue sky, blue ocean range of possibilities and experiences that I know that we just haven't seen before, but that I'm incredibly excited over the next couple years to see yourself and other people think of and imagine and bring to life. The next one for me is Instant. And I'll use the 360 as an example of one of the most cutting-edge TV platforms out there. After all, it runs games like Call of Duty and the latest Halo that have cutting-edge graphics. But if you actually take out a stopwatch and you time how long it takes to launch an app, you're looking at anywhere between 15 and 30 seconds. And that's actually a great number. Like, 15 seconds, we had champagne bottles out and we were like partying. That was kind of the state of the art of you were like the performance guru if you could get your app down to launch in that amount of time. But now with Xbox One, apps are launching in seconds. And switching is actually so fast. Like, if I want to switch from Netflix to a game to something else, it actually happens so fast. We tried to time it, but it's in literally like handfuls of milliseconds. It wasn't even worth measuring. It's that fast. And so users have a different expectation about how long it takes to jump into an activity, and all the activities now that you can quickly multitask between them, sort of the different experiences that enables. And that's my third, and I actually saved multitasking for last because it's the most subtle one, but I think it's actually also one of the most transformative pieces. On Xbox One, you can snap an experience to the side of another experience. You can run a game at the same time as snapping TV. And it seems like a small thing, but I'll take you back to, if you remember in the phone world, before we had smartphones, and I thought that the most important thing that when I went and picked out a phone was like, how well can it make phone calls? And that was pretty much all I thought about. And then we moved to a world where phones had app ecosystems and could quickly switch between experiences. And you think about, like, now it'd be crazy to think about me buying a phone or you buying a phone that couldn't do all of those things. And I really, really believe that multitasking is gonna be one of those same things where years from now, we'll wonder how we actually interacted with our television screens in a world where, you mean if I had to browse the internet, I actually had to shut down my game, wait for the internet to start up, check something, shut down the internet, and we really had to do that. But, you know, that's all gonna change. And the other interesting thing about this is Xbox One really treats multitasking as a first-class citizen. What that means for you guys as app developers and as creative people is to think about the fact that this creates a whole new interaction paradigm where we are now starting to see the beginnings of some experiences that people create that actually exist as snap-only experiences. And those are experiences that are contextual to what you're doing on the other side. And I'll give you an example of an app that you'll be playing a game and you'll get stuck on a certain level and you just can't beat the boss. But the Snap app over here, if you bring it in, will contextually start populating some videos of how you go beat that boss. And then you can see the video, and then you can go back and you can go beat the boss. And so like little things like that are really, really starting to change how we think about experiences on the television screen. And now I'm going to do a dive into the actual architecture of Xbox One. First, I'll start with the problem statement of what we were trying to solve. We spent a bunch of time. We knew we had to build a system that made the top game developers incredibly productive. We knew we had to have a lot of RAM. We knew we had to have great GPU. We know we had to have fixed hardware that didn't change over time. That's something that game developers like. They like to develop to the metal. And because they can develop to the metal, they can get some amazing graphics so that if they were doing something that had to cross a lot of devices, they wouldn't be able to necessarily do. And they get to make a lot of very architecture-specific choices in their code, knowing that it's not going to change and it's going to be very consistent over time, so they're not going to have to keep tuning it or worry about things breaking them and things like that. So we had this one very, very stable, to-the-metal, raw, like, development environment and developer that we had to go satisfy. But at the same time, we knew that, especially with smartphones starting to become a real big thing, a lot of different form factors for devices and the proliferation of applications and the constantly changing landscape, that there was this other world that was changing very, very fast. And it was developers who were building on technologies like HTML5 and the web, and were quickly throwing things together, pulling data from multiple sources, and innovating at an incredible rate. And so we had this challenge, which was like, how do we build one system that makes these guys happy, who actually want stability and little change, low level access, and then another set of guys who want a bunch of great OS features that keep innovating and growing with them as they want to innovate. And we kept on coming up with different architectures, and every single time we came up with one, it was one that somebody got the short end of the stick. It was either the app developer or the game developer. And so finally, we landed on what ended up becoming the Xbox One architecture, which is we said, you know what? We'll just build multiple operating systems. We'll just do more than one. And you have to imagine that. I mean, it's still a little bit crazy to think about. But at the time, it was really crazy kind of to think about that you'll build multiple operating systems. But we didn't. We built one operating system that which we call the exclusive partition that is really tuned for that game developer and gives them to-the-metal access like they're used to having and is very, very stable backwards compatibility through time. And then we have another operating system which we call the shared partition, and that one really is Windows. And we picked Windows, and we spent a lot of money, we spent a lot of time to put Windows on there. And the reason why we wanted to do that was because we wanted to leverage all of the skills and knowledge that you guys have to bring to the table to build apps, and then to make it easier to share that code, like you saw in the last, if you were in the last presentation, across the different platforms. And over on the shared partition side, all the apps are running. We've got Windows. The shell actually runs inside of that partition. And a lot of the operating system. And then the third guy, because I mentioned we had three operating systems, is the host OS. He's a very thin operating system that mediates between the other operating systems and allows, this is the thing that enables you to very quickly switch between a game and an app and not actually know that you're actually switching between these different partitions. So that takes us to kind of the what we want to talk about today, which is the HTML5 platform. But before we get there, I want to kind of take a step back and think about, like, because on the original Xbox, we actually didn't have an app platform, much less a UI platform. You could draw DirectX triangles, and that was sort of like the gist of what you could do. But we only had one actual UI page, so it was kind of okay. You could go to settings and change the clock, and you could play a game, and that was about it. And then for 360, we went further, and we had the Blades interface, which is a vertical interface that people still like a lot. But then we moved to different things, and we rapidly kind of outgrew that model and very quickly iterated and got UI platforms. And so we've come a long, long way, and I think a lot of people still think we're in that age where you have to write DirectX to write a console application, but we've moved well beyond that. And so that's what I want to talk to you about today. Specifically, we're HTML5, CSS3, IE10, and so you don't have to worry about if you've done cross-browser development and you worry about some older browser support, on Xbox One, you can do full HTML5 and CSS3 code. We have WinJS, but as was mentioned in the last talk, it's not a mandatory thing. If you've got jQuery, that's totally cool. And in fact, I use it myself. And then we also have the Windows runtime. So these are all the Windows APIs that you get in addition to standard web APIs that you'd expect. And the other thing that's really, really exciting, and this is actually a big deal for us, is that you get access, and we worked really, really hard on this one, so that you guys get full access to everything Xbox has from JavaScript. Okay, and that means you get access to Kinect. So if you want to, you can run skeletal processing in JavaScript if you want to. I will admit it's not the fastest way to do it, but you can. You get access to Smart Glass, the controller, the live services, all those kinds of things you can access via JavaScript. And another thing not everybody knows is you can even mix in C++ code. And that's part of the same mechanism that we use for Windows and Windows Phone to do that, which is WinRT. And this is really great for code reuse. And so if you guys have libraries where you're working on another platform, then you can bring that over and reuse that code via a WinRT component. And the last bullet point, DirectX C++, I won't talk about that too much, only to mention that it's there. People use it today. It's more for games. We tend to see more usage on the game side than the app side for it, but it's also there as well. So now I want to give like a really concrete example of what it means to take something from the web, or in this case, we're going to take it from Windows and port it to Xbox. And I'll talk about my experience porting the list view, which if you've used WinJS, you've probably used the list view, in porting that controller over to Xbox. So first I'll show you a list view. So now here's a little subtle point that I'm gonna point out, and you'll notice in my demo. So all of my demos are actually running on Windows. I don't run my demos on Xbox, even though I have plenty of dev kits, to kind of prove a point. And the point is that really the platforms are actually similar enough that, and this is a true story, like I'm an operating system developer, and I work on the core guts of the operating system, and I do 90% of my development for Xbox One on Windows. Like, really. So this is running on Windows, but it would look exactly the same on an Xbox. And again, like I said in the beginning, when you think about bringing something to Xbox, think about four things. There's 10-foot experience, and so you'll notice that the tiles are a little bit bigger than you'd see if you were on a tablet or certainly the phone. And then think about the inputs. And so it's based on a grid. The Windows list view is based on a grid too, but that's really great for controller navigation. And there's default focus set. That's a subtle one, but a default focus is set in the upper left corner there. And then what we also did was we used a syntax, which I'll go into later exactly how this works, to enable the list view for voice. And then we also enabled, we actually didn't do any work for this one, but it actually just worked with gesture. And I'll talk about how that magic happened as well. So first thing I want to talk about is I want to talk about we're going to go deep into the controller. And the controller, when I say controller, what I really mean is directional navigation. And so this is a remote control. This is a controller. This is actually also how Smart Glass works too, when you navigate the dashboard, and any other device that does directional navigation. And unlike other platforms that you may be familiar with, on the TV, users are used to using directional navigation. That's kind of their main method of interacting with applications. So now I'll show you a quick demo. And so we have this feature that we call automatic focus. And what it does, you actually don't have to write any code. And for the most part, this is how controller navigation just works. But I'm going to show you a little bit under the covers just so you understand kind of what's going on here. First of all, I've got a simple grid of items. And if I go over to the right, you'd expect it to go to B. If I go over to the right again, where would you expect it to go? C. OK, so it does that. And if you go back, you go to B. Now here's a question. We'll see if anyone can get this one. So this is an easy one. If I go right from F, I go to B. If I go right again, oh, let's see. Oh, you guys are too smart. OK. Yeah, you go to G. Why didn't I go to C? It's because the algorithm's actually quite smart, and we spent a whole bunch of time thinking about and studying UI patterns for the television. And so not only does it pick kind of the nearest neighbor to go to, it actually has the notion of a history and heuristics around the fact that when it goes from F to B to G, the user is navigating along the bottom, and it should go do that. So it's actually it's quite sophisticated, and it handles almost every single case you could throw at it. And so that's why I say that you don't really have to write any special code to make this happen. And it knows things like, it knows that buttons are focusable, it knows that text boxes are focusable, and things like that. And so you don't have to write any code. You can just bring it over, and for the most part, you'll notice that directional navigation works. So here's some design considerations you want to keep in mind for the controller. One, keep it simple. We have a lot of buttons on the controller, but we like to stick to, for common things, A selects, B goes back or cancels, or dismisses an overlay, and then the left thumbstick and the D-pad for directional navigation. It's totally fine to use X and Y for some advanced features, but keep them to more advanced features because, one, that's a little bit harder to discover, and two, some of these buttons don't exist on all devices like remotes. Always set default focus, and that's something that if you're coming from a different platform, this will be a subtle one, but it's really important to your users because of the nature of having to navigate around with a controller. If you can set their default focus on that button that they're most likely to interact with, you can save them a lot of time. Another thing you want to do is remember to trigger your actions on key up instead of key down if it's not a repeatable action. And I mean that by, let's say, navigating back. Navigating back is something that should happen on when I lift off of B, because if I held it down, then I would continually navigate backwards. And so that's something that if you worked on other non-TV platforms, you might not be aware of that one. Now we'll get into some code. Use automatic focus is what most of our apps do, and it generally just works. Then you also want to respond to the click event. And so for buttons, we've kind of done that work to wire up so that if you have a button, the user presses A on the controller, it's going to fire the click handler. So again, if your button already responds to click and you're coming from the web, that just works. And then when you want to actually read controller input, we also did a bunch of work, again, to make it really, really easy and fit into your existing code patterns to make all that gamepad input come through as key codes, so it'll feel like a keyboard. And a lot of cases where we port code from different platforms, it's as simple as adding another if statement or another case statement to check for the gamepad key codes. And we even do it for the joystick. And so you don't have to worry about something we call like dead zone detection, which is if I press up and then a little bit this way, is it an up or is it a left? And we got all that logic built in, and it just surfaces as, we'll tell you when it's a left, we'll tell you when it's an up, and you just respond appropriately. Of course, you can get at that other data. We even have polling APIs where you can, on a loop, and that's more for games, but I just want to point out that you're not restricted when you're developing using HTML5. You have the full range of APIs that anyone else has. Next, we'll talk about gesture. First, the most important thing about our gesture was figuring out what our interaction model was going to be. And we went through a lot of different things. On the 360, we had a model where you would hold out your hand and a little timer would appear and then it would activate. So that was one model. We did a bunch of tests and we decided to do something that was a little bit more direct and felt natural. And so users can just press and then activate different elements. And that actually worked out really, really well, and it tested great. People just got it. They went up, they started pressing things, and they just understood how that worked. There was one problem, though. And the problem was some people pressed like this. Some people pressed kind of like that. And we had one lady who actually like pressed like that and expected it to work. And so we went back to the drawing board, and we said, how do we go figure out how that can actually all work and feel natural to all these people? And we came up with this notion of attraction, which is kind of the pseudo-magnetism that as your hand is over an element, no matter which direction you press, even that lady who is doing this, from the UI perspective, the hand will move smoothly toward the center of the button. And to the user, you actually don't know that really know that that's happening, and you think that you're just pressing. So give a quick demo, go back to this one. And again, I'm running on Windows, and this is not a real Kinect hand, but if I click one of these things, then I'll end up going into the details page, and then I can also grab and hold. And that's effectively how it works. So some of the design considerations you want to think about when you're building for gesture is make sure your targets are easy to hit. And the ideal size is 200 by 200 pixels is kind of an ideal size that makes it really easy to press things. A minimum is 100 by 100, and you want to avoid the edges of the screen, mostly because this is really fatiguing, because it uses small shoulder muscles actually to do this exercise instead of kind of your bigger muscles down here. And then the worst is anything toward the bottom of the screen. And that's because when the user does this, then they disengage. That's how they disengage. They drop their hand. And so you're going to get users who are frustrated if they try to keep hitting the bottom of the screen and they just keep disengaging. The mouse is not quite the same thing as the pointer APIs. And so that's just a subtle thing that if you're building an application today on Windows, and you want to know, how do I build it so that it will work great with Kinect and gesture? Think about building it for pointer, which is touch, and think about those APIs more than kind of the traditional mouse APIs. Some of the strategies you can use, because a lot of people ask me and they say, 200 by 200 is huge. I'm not going to make every single button 200 by 200. What do I do? And that's okay, we don't make every single button 200 by 200 either. Our back button's actually a lot smaller than that, it's 50 pixels. But you can actually, the hittable area just has to be that size. And so we just have a bunch of margin around our back button that you can, if you press around there, you'll still activate it. And that gets around the issue. Now I wanna take a peek kind of under the covers, and we'll take a look at how Kinect works at a deeper level. So the way it appears to your app code is just as a pointer. And so you're going to get pointer events, like pointer move when the user does this. You're going to get pointer down, pointer up. You'll even get pointer hover. And you can even get a right click when they press and hold. So the pointer events are, you'd be surprised. And we actually do this all the time, where we point a web browser at some of the cool HTML5 demo sites. And you just start dragging and playing with it like this. And it just works. And it's pretty cool. And there's a lot of code running under the covers to make that magic happen. At the very lowest level, The Kinect is reading in depth data, and it's reading in the person's skeleton, and it's finding that point that's the hand and that's the center, and then it's passing that point up to the rendering engine for the browser, specifically the touch interaction engine, which is a component of code that actually exists in Windows as well, which turns arbitrary gestures into things like scrolls, pans. It gives velocities and inertias to your actions. And then that all comes up to your app as pointer events, or if you have a scrollable region, you don't have to do anything. Just overflow scroll in your CSS, and then the user can do this to scroll it. And the cursor is rendered by the system, so you don't have to worry about drawing that either. And there's a way to do custom cursors as well. The API for attraction, we talked about that notion of attraction a little while ago, isn't even really much of an API. It's just a CSS attribute. And this top line is actually a cut and paste of the CSS rule from WinJS. And so if you're using WinJS, don't do anything. Your case is already covered. But if you're not, you can copy and paste the same rule and put it in your CSS file. And what this says is that all the buttons, all the input tags, the select tags, the links, and we have a special class WinFocusable for other things that are focusable, given an MS attraction of all zeros. And that's a special value that says leave it up to the system to figure out where to put the attraction region. Because if you have a small button, it makes sense to put the attraction region in as the hand gravitates toward the center of the button. But let's say your button's half the screen. Do you really want the hand to gravitate toward the center of that giant button? And so putting all zeros, the system will be smart about choosing some local near point to have it attract to. And then, of course, if you want to turn it off for some reason, we almost never use this, but let's say I had a button on the page that I don't want to have attraction, then I set MS attraction to none. Here's a few additional topics, and actually the talk right after this one is all about Kinect, and so I'll leave some of those things for Kinect. But I just want to quickly mention that if you do want to go deeper, because we worked really hard to make it easy for anybody to pull a JavaScript touch library, touch gesture library, and suddenly have that work with Kinect. And so we did a bunch of work to make that easy. But if you want to go deeper, we got some really cool tools, like a visual gesture builder is one of my favorite ones, where you can do a punch a few times and then record that and then bring it into your game. We have full skeletal body data, so you can actually get down to rotations on a hand and the position in 3D space of those things. And then so full body data. And then also the gesture recognizer class from Windows, which takes touch events and then turns those into swipes, drags, and it exposes those as more high-level events for you. So the next and last input we're going to talk about is voice. And I've got a mock-up here on kind of what it looks like. And hidden in these slides, maybe later, you know, when they get posted, you guys can read through them, but there's just some tips on best practices to do with voice. But in the Xbox world, you say Xbox select, and voice gets engaged. These things turn green to tell you that you can interact with them. And then when you say the phrase, then it will trigger what's on screen. So I want to talk about some design considerations for voice, and these are some concepts, a little bit dense, but I'll try to explain them all. So there's this notion of a dynamic phrase versus a static phrase, and all that is just a conceptual thing as we talk about voice, where dynamic means that it's coming from the cloud, maybe you don't know what it is beforehand. So for instance, you got an RSS feed of data coming in, and that could be anything on that day. Maybe you know you don't know what the weather is, or you don't know what the top items are. And then static phrases, these are things like maybe on a details page, you have add to my queue, play, rate. These are phrases that don't change a lot. And the only reason why those are interesting to differentiate is because as a developer, the strategies that you use on each one is very different. On the static phrases, you can tune those and usability test the heck out of them. On the dynamic phrases, you can't as much. And another thing you want to make sure is that you don't have too many phrases. I put no greater than 20, but honestly, you can actually go a little bit beyond that. We're actually still figuring out what that upper limit is. 20 was a 360 number. You also don't want to have too many characters for phrases, and really that one is about just fatigue of the user doesn't want to have to say a giant sentence every time they want to add something to their queue. So keeping that sentence short just makes a better experience for them. Avoid the words that just aren't pronounceable, like abbreviations or pink. Numbers are fine, though. We've got numbers. And you even want to consider actually using item 1, item 2, item 3. If you have a phrase that you don't really know what it is and it might be hard to say, a good example of that is if you've got a media application and it's in the United States, but there's a Japanese anime or Korean drama section. It would be really, really hard to say those names, and so probably item 1, item 2 is better than trying to have people pronounce them and fail. And the last thing to think about is who your target audience is. If your target audience is mostly kids, and we hit this when we were developing the Sesame Street application, where we built a bunch of complex phrases up, and then we brought these kids in to try it, and the kids just would not recognize any of what they said, because they were pretty much just mumbling and pointing at the screen. And so what we did was, you want to play with this notion of how many false accepts are okay versus how many are not okay. And in the world of kids, it's actually okay to have a lot of false accepts. And so we actually lowered the what we call a confidence threshold of how confident the voice system needs to be in a phrase you've said to trigger the action down really low, so that the kid could pretty much say anything and it would do the one action that was on the screen. But then on the flip side, if you have a more mature audience, you want to lower those false accepts so that as they're doing side chatter and stuff like that, or in my household, if I'm talking about Xbox, which happens a lot, that I don't, you know, just start triggering things all over the place. Now I'll show you guys a quick voice demo. So going over here, we'll go back. It's a little more impressive. If I say Xbox Select, then we got the voice labels, and I can do something like go to my queue, whoops, caps lock. And now I went to the queue. So now we're gonna take a peek at voice under the hood, and I'll show you how it works from an API perspective. So this is the simplest example. And what we've done is we've created a declarative syntax that you can just decorate your HTML elements with, and then they become voice-enabled. And so you put data in voice, and you tell us what phrase you want, and then whenever the user says play, then the click event for that play button is going to get triggered, and all your code that you already wrote to handle click is going to happen, and the movie's going to start playing. So that's the simplest example, and a bunch of people will probably just stop at that and won't do anything more. Here's a more complicated one, but also is more typical as applications start to get bigger, because the downside of the first example is if I have to do localization, then I have to also localize my voice phrase. And then maybe that play button is actually a play pause toggle, and maybe when I click it, it changes to pause and then changes to play. I don't want to have to keep updating that thing. And so we have this notion of a source element, and the source element says, just make life easy for me, and my voice phrase is always going to be whatever is inside the text of that button is going to be what my voice phrase is. So just use that. And it takes a CSS selector, so in that case, we got this class display text that's got play. And so no matter what I change that to, whether it's French, Japanese, English, play pause, doesn't matter, or nothing, the voice system is just gonna know that that's what I want, and it's gonna trigger whatever that phrase is in that person's language, and they can play it. And so you'll start to see that pattern a lot if you look at samples. And then target element, this one you'll almost, you may not end up overriding too much, but that's this notion of the text that turns green might not actually be the same text as where you pulled the voice phrase from. And an example of that is, let's say instead of play, this was a movie title, and the title of the movie was Harry Potter. Then I might want my voice text to actually show up on a different element over here, and maybe it says video one, so that I can still see that movie title as I'm choosing to select it. So that's why we have that extra one. And I'm gonna show you next And you got to promise not to get scared, because I guarantee I've never actually seen an example this complicated ever exist in practice. But it does show every single property that you can set. So we talked about source element and target element. Handler is if you don't want it to be the click event, you actually want some other JavaScript method to be called specifically when triggered with voice. And then pronunciation, Eminem, the artist, if you just saw it and you try to actually say it, it wouldn't trigger because it's got this special pronunciation. And then confidence we talked about a little bit. And confidence is how confident does the voice system have to be in what the user just said in terms of a pattern match in order to trigger that phrase. If you don't know what a good value is, I recommend leaving the default in there. But if you find after testing you want to change it, then that's how you do it. Now I'm going to give you a peek under the covers at the code we wrote to enable that whole speech system that I just showed you guys. So the first thing we did is when the user says Xbox, then what happens is the UI framework goes through and it actually grabs all the strings and all the data and the text, and then it goes and it registers those with a voice system that's running on the Kinect. And it says, hey, listen for these phrases. And then when the user, and then it also goes up to the UI and it puts the right CSS classes on there that color things green. And then when the user says the phrase, what the voice system does is it recognizes the phrase and it says, was it the right confidence? Yes, it was. All right. Do I have in my map of UI elements and function callbacks to voice phrases? And it finds it, and then it goes and it calls that callback. And then your code gets triggered. And so I always like to do this slide because I think having you guys understand how it works under the covers really gives you the tools that when you need to go optimize it or debug it or understand how it works, you now have a kind of conceptual understanding of what that code is doing that I demoed a little bit earlier. And so so that's it. So we went through and looked at 10-foot. We looked at controller. We looked at gesture. We looked at voice. A quick note on this slide. If you're a developer who does middleware or you're an agency who builds apps on behalf of other people, then we really, really want you to send an email to the developer partner program because we really want to hear from you. So if you're kind of in that bucket, then, or even if you don't quite know if you're in that bucket, send an email. And again, that's kind of think about like agencies, you sort of build apps on behalf of other people. Type of a thing, then come talk to us. We'd love to hear from you. Xbox One's built on the Windows core, and again, that's going to be a theme you're going to hear again and again, which is take that Windows knowledge that you have, and actually even just web knowledge that you have, and use it to go leverage the work that we've done to go bring your experiences to Xbox One. And the last bullet point, and I really mean this, and I'm sincere, like, we have an expert one-on-one room where we've actually taken, like, I will be there. We have our design manager is going to be there. We have guys from our business team who are going to be there. And I actually mean it, like, I get so much out of this when I talk to you guys one-on-one. And you work on something for years and years so that you can see really amazing experiences be built on top of that. And to me, that's what it's all about. And so I'm gonna be down right after this in that expert one-on-one room. I'll be there tomorrow. And I want to talk with as many of you guys as I can. I want to hear your cool ideas. And then I want to help you in any way that I can. And this last slide is just, and I'll leave it up there as I go into questions, is just about the survey. And so we got the QR code here. And so fill out your surveys. And with that, once again, really, really thank you for coming in here. And I hope that I can actually speak with every one of you kind of on an individual basis in our expert one-on-one. Thank you. All right, and if you have a question, I've been asked by the tech folk to walk up to the mic so that those who are listening online can hear the question. All right, no questions. Okay, all right. Yeah, walk up to the mic just so that the guys can hear.
I'm wondering if there is a way to get a development kit without signing for the independent developer program or any of the game
publishing programs. All right, well, actually, thank you for the question. I'm glad that I actually have Rob Cameron here with me. Do you have a mic?
I don't have a mic.
Okay, well, come up here, and yeah, you, so, yeah. Introduce yourself, and then you
so
can...
So, my name is Rob Cameron. I'm a principal program manager with Xbox. I'll be presenting tomorrow. So, the question was, hey, can I get a dev kit without actually joining the program? And, you know, we get this question a lot, you know, hey, can I take a retail kit, turn it to dev kit? It's something that we've announced as a vision, but it's not possible today, but something that we're working on. When we do it, you'll definitely know when you can.
And come by Experts One-on-One. Come by, but yeah,
no.
Yeah. Come by Experts One-on-One, though.
Yet.
Yeah,
yeah. Let's say not yet.
Yeah, yeah.
But we really want to enable it. Any other questions?
Yeah, we got some.
I've got a question about the performance. I've been testing i10 on Xbox One, and it's not as fast as the 8-core CPU we've got. Do we have the same performance of i10 on Xbox One as in the current Xbox One application in HTML5?
Great question. So, yeah, we do. So, the way to think about it is the performance on Xbox One is going to be so we got IE10 running, so that's one kind of baseline that you have. And then the actual specs, we don't have you're not going to have the full 8 cores running, but you'll have a lot of them. I find that the one difference, I think, from a performance perspective to keep in mind when doing Xbox One is that. We don't do JIT on Xbox One today, so that'll affect your specific JavaScript scenarios. I wouldn't say everyone, only specific ones. But I found after having profiled literally, no joke, like hundreds of apps, usually you're bounded on rendering more than JavaScript, so that tends not to be as big a deal. But I think where I find the big perf issues are, you know, they're the same as kind of when you do any kind of web development, which is minimize your layout calls. Minimize how much DOM is on screen that you have to render. Those are kind of, you know, the top level things. And if you want to go deep on that stuff, come to Experts One-on-One, and I'd love to, you know, go deep on that subject. Yep.
Hello. I had two questions. The first one is just following up on that. So I understand these WinJS apps will run on top of the IE10, or they will run on a separate component. And the second was that how is the distribution of these applications?
Great. So the first question is, do these all run on top of IE10? And they do run on top of IE10. IE10 provides, just like on Windows, it provides that core rendering and input engine to kind of power the app. And just like on Windows, you're going to write web code, but there's some subtle differences on the fact that you don't have to do network requests to get your images and things like that. And you have access to certain APIs that wouldn't be allowed for a website, like Connect and users and things like that. And then, did that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay, and then your second question was about distribution. And by distribution, do you mean like the store distribution?
Yeah, store, like as a developer, how would I distribute these applications made in JavaScript for
okay.
Xbox?
So I will, you know, that's for Rob's area. You want to grab a mic, Rob? Just because I know this guy's going to get upset at something.
Sure. I try to grab Mike, but to answer your question, is obviously we have a marketplace where you can download apps on Xbox One. We are working to, you know, enable that marketplace to a broader set of developers. We're not there yet, and we don't really have any announcements to make at this time on that, but it is something that we want to do. I heard the keynotes this morning.
Okay. Yeah, thanks for the question. All right.
Mike is loud. So I've done a bit of smart glass development.
Oh, awesome.
On
very
a couple
cool.
projects and SRAs.
Oh, very cool.
Is there plans to integrate those two platforms a little tighter so you can built applications
okay.
that go across web, SRA,
yeah,
and smart glass.
You know what I'm going to say on that one cuz smart glass is near and dear to my heart. And Alen too, who is well. First, go meet Alen. He's speaking
tomorrow
okay. at a full session on smart glass.
Sure.
And I definitely recommend going and hearing him talk about that. Also, visit us at Experts One-on-One. I have a lot of thoughts on that.
Okay.
I think at a high level is, I totally get the scenario where you're coming from, and I really want to work to make that And we all want to work to make that better.
Sure.
And we can get specific at Expert
Yeah,
I'm
happy to get specific, so I'll look you up.
Yeah, great. Yeah, go for it.
I've got a specific question from one of my friends on Twitter.
Okay.
He's asking me if you're mapping the Kinect's touch gesture to the pointer event model.
Yep.
That's right. He's asking me if it's mapping to touch behavior or to the mouse behavior for instance, the over class going to be red or not, thing like that.
Great question. I'm actually glad that he asked, because it's a subtle one that, like, unless you get kind of down in the details, you don't know the difference, but touch, it's touch. Yeah, that's a touch one. Oh, here, yeah.
Sorry, I came back for one question. Are you planning to integrate Cortana to Xbox?
So, that's an interesting question. Haven't gotten that one before, but I would say, Xbox One is enabled for voice today. You can interact with it. As far as Cortana, we did not make any announcements on that and integrate with Xbox One, but it's an interesting idea.
Well, it comes from there, right? So.
That's right.
A little game called Halo, right? Yeah. Cool. Well, thanks, guys. We'll stick around. Again, probably here for a little bit in the Experts one-on-one. And we got to let you guys get to the next session. So thanks again for coming. Really appreciate it.